Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. Today we're going to be talking with Margaret Brucia, author of The Key to Everything, Mae Swenson, A Writer's Life. Mae Swenson was one of the most important and original poets of the 20th century. The Key to Everything is a biography of this experimental American modernist that draws directly from her unpublished diaries and her letters to friends, family, and colleagues, most notably Elizabeth Bishop. In 1952, Swenson wrote in her diary, "I want to confirm my life in a narrative. My lesbianism, the hereditary background of my parents, grandparents, origins in the old country." Taking up Swenson's uncompleted autobiographical plan, Margaret Brucia tells Swenson's story as much as possible through her own words. Margaret Brucia is a Fulbright scholar, recipient of a fellowship from the National Endowment for the Humanities, and a fellow of the American Academy in Rome. Trained as a classicist, she has a special interest in women's diaries and letters. Margaret Brucia, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
So we'll jump into this. And I should mention for those maybe in other parts of the state who don't know that Logan is Mae Swenson's hometown, right? And so a lot of Mae Swenson evident in Logan and at Utah State University, but in other areas, maybe some things that we'll be learning as we go along with this. So first of all, Margaret Brucia, you're a big part of your career has been as a Latin teacher. How did you go from that to a Mae Swenson biography?
I'm glad you asked, because a lot of people do ask that same question. I spent 40 years of my professional career as a Latin teacher. I taught high school kids, undergraduates, graduates, and even Latin teachers. My specialty is Augustan poetry, so my poets are Catullus, Horace, Virgil, and Ovid, a far cry from the modernist poets. But there is a path to Mae Swenson, which I'll trace for you. I retired from teaching high school Latin in 2004, and shortly thereafter I was offered a position in Rome at Temple University's Rome campus, teaching mostly junior year abroad students, which I happily accepted. And I taught in Rome in the spring semester for 8 years. And one Sunday in April of 2010, I went to the market, the flea market in Porta Portese, which is the Sunday flea market, the big market of Rome. And I discovered in the market a collection of over 200 letters that were written by a New York socialite named Julia Gardner Daly to her daughter. And I purchased these letters and was mesmerized by their contents. They were unfiltered letters, never intended for publication, private, intimate details of their lives. And from that moment on, I became fascinated with women's private writings and diaries. And in the course of working with these letters and meeting the family and the descendants, I then decided to publish a series on the letters. And I published a series of 8 articles on the City University of New York's Gotham blog for New York history about the situation between Julia Gardner Daly and her daughter and the letters that they exchanged. And having done that, I was pleased, of course, to read those, and in a way a little bit sorry that phase was ending. And then so I published the letters in 2017, and then 2 years later, in 2019, sort of out of the blue, I received an email from the literary executor of the Mae Swenson Literary Estate, and she knew of my interest in women's diaries and letters and invited me to write or to consider writing a biography of Mae Swenson. And the lure was that she had not archived as yet the diaries of Mae Swenson. So I would be able to have early access to the writings of Mae. And of course, I was intrigued. I didn't know a whole lot about Mae when I accepted, but I did accept, and I accepted enthusiastically once I read the diaries themselves. So from being a Latin teacher to going to Rome to going to the flea market, finding letters. That's how I wrote the biography of Mae Swenson.
Yeah, and it's the result is fascinating. The key to everything. So unpublished diaries, right? Letters. What else did you get access to?
Well, the diaries, as I mentioned, had been unaccessed. I mean, had been unarchived, and so those were my early access to them was particularly exciting. The letters were mostly in the Washington University in St. Louis archives. I traveled to St. Louis and read many of May's letters to her family, to her friends, and those became a very important source, her own words. also, in 1994, May died in 1989, so 5 years after her death, her last lover, whose name was Roseanne Knudsen, known as Zan, very fortunately arranged for interviews with six of May's siblings. And so those were also in St. Louis. And I got to listen to May's siblings' memories of her as a child and their memories of her through life. So that was a very important source. I had conversations with people who knew May, most notably the poet Edward Field, who is now 101 and sharp as a tack and remembered May very well. And he gave me some insights into her personality and what she was like. The poet Grace Shulman also knew May personally. A neighbor of May's in Seacliff, where I live now, named Sally Reynolds, recalled many incidents with May and she just adored May. And a musician, Andrew Rudin, spoke to me about being at Yaddo with May. So I had the wonderful accounts of people who knew her, direct accounts. So I was given access to the diaries only until 1959. The ones that survived date from 1935 until 1959. And I wanted to tell the story to the end of May's life. And fortunately, when those diaries sort of abated, Elizabeth Bishop correspondence came into being. May and Elizabeth Bishop corresponded for 29 years from 1950 until Elizabeth Bishop's death in 1979. And their correspondence was long and mostly about poetry, but also about life in general. So that became a very important source. And then Zan, May's third lover, also published after her death some biographical material. One was aimed at young readers, called The Wonderful Pen of Mae Swenson. And she also published a book, A Poet's Life in Photos, and both of those were very valuable sources, as well as Paul Crumley and Patricia Gantz's Body My House, which is a collection of essays and about Mae's life and works. So those were my principal sources. But also there were poems, and although my interest and my specialty is not in modernist poetry, I was able to extrapolate from her collection of poems those that I thought added to an autobiographical kind of account of her life, and things that I could pinpoint in her life. And those included poems of memories from her youth, a poem called Lion, a poem called The Centaur, that she wrote when a memory of when she was 10 years old. When she went to Salt Lake City, she wrote a poem called Jupiter Street, kind of imagining herself in another setting. She wrote a poem called Haymaking, which was actually her first breakthrough poem when she was traveling from Salt Lake City to New York. She wrote a poem called In Spoonfuls while she was struggling and trying to get a grip on how to go about becoming a professional poet. When she missed home, she wrote a poem called Mirage, which was a sort of an account of her nightly memories of home she was very homesick when she in her early years in New York. And another one, The Seed of My Father, which she wrote after the death of her father. So in terms of sources, I had quite a few wonderful, valuable, and helpful sources.
Let's jump into a little of her background. This is part of her outline, right, which you're following. She said, I want to confirm my life and narrative. And part of that is hereditary background, my parents, grandparents, and origins in the old country. Old country, we're talking about Sweden, right? These are her grandparents, yes. Converted to the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. I guess that's a starting point. And at that point, we're under intense persecution.
Yes, absolutely. So fortunately, May's father, Dan Arthur Swenson, left a 130-page autobiography, and in it he spoke about his own conversion and his parents and his family and their and the Swenson family's journey from Sweden to Utah. And so that really was a wonderful help to me in understanding May's background. And yes, so what I can tell you about that is that her grandparents, Sven and Tilda Persson, Sven Swenson and Tilda Persson, grew up in Grodby, Sweden, and her grandfather was the youngest of seven children and the only one to attend university. He actually traveled 400 miles to go to school in Lund, Sweden. And when he was there, he fell in love with and married the boarding house landlady's daughter, Tilda. And they married, Sven became a teacher, and he was productive and happy as a teacher. And then mysteriously, no reason is given, he lost his job after teaching for several years. And by that time, they had eight children, and they had to move to a three-bedroom cottage because they had no income, no money. And at that point, Mormon missionaries came and spoke to them about Mormonism, and they were captivated by what they learned about the Mormon view of love and family and generosity and the fact that there was the opportunity to go to this refuge in Zion. And the Swenson family converted. Dan was baptized. And then piecemeal, the family migrated to avoid the persecution that they were undergoing for being Mormon. They traveled in dribs and drabs to Utah. And eventually, in 1896, the year that Utah became a state, they converged. They got together and started their life as a family in Utah. Dan, May's father, worked on farms. He had no more than a fifth grade education when he learned that there was a university in Logan and he wanted to attend. And so at the age of 20, with a fifth grade education, Dan Swenson traveled to Logan and went and enrolled in Utah Agricultural College then, and obviously needed a great deal of remedial work to do a college curriculum. But he writes in his autobiography that after a year of help from loving and generous teachers, he was reading Milton, Walter Scott, Washington Irving, and just fascinated with literature. And it was May's father who was such a huge influence on May. But it's important to realize that May grew up in this family, and her first language was, in fact, Swedish. So her Swedish background was extremely important to her. And she grew up in a devout Mormon household. She was the eldest of 10 children, and she worked hard and helped her parents. And her father was very sensitive to her own need for just solitude and introspection. And he made for her 20 small books and encouraged May to write about her life and to just sort of solve our own problems by writing them down in these books. Unfortunately, they don't survive, but this was a major breakthrough and was the reason that May became a lifelong diarist.
Tell me a little bit about young May, she, oldest of, what would you say, 10, living in Logan, right? You write about how we have records of some of the books that May checked out from the Logan Library, right? In one of her, some of her poems, she talks about how she feels like her natural habitat is outdoors, running through the wilds. Tell me about the young May Swenson.
She started kindergarten speaking Swedish. So first she had to learn English, and she did, of course, and loved school from the very beginning. And teachers were impressed with her ability and her interest and the fact that she had learned English so well. And there's a family story, I guess, that circulated among the children that was told and retold, that on May's first day of school, she got back, her parents asked her how it was, and she said, oh, it was wonderful. They had a fountain with lemonade, and after playtime, we had pink ice cream and chocolate cake, and she imagined all these things, of course, that didn't happen, but they're indicative of her fertile imagination and her positive outlook. And so as a young child, she loved school. We do have records of what she read, she was a voracious reader. She read the Oz series, The Wizard of Oz, and all the books in the Oz series. She most probably read Little Women and children's classics, and had friends with whom she played and ran in the woods and had a wonderful childhood when she wasn't working, which was a lot of the time. So she sought solitude. I mean, imagine living in a small house as the oldest of 10 children. She naturally sought refuge from it all. And she herself talks of seeking out haystacks and burrowing in and going up to the roof of her father's woodshed and reading and imagining and dreaming and all the things children do. So that was what her young years were like.
Right, yeah. Well, let's take a brief break. When we come back, I want to talk about as she gets into high school at Utah State Agricultural College. Then we'll get into talking about her literary ambitions. She really wanted to be a poet. Fellow Sirens Call to New York. I talk about her sexual orientation as well, which is a big, of course, impact on her life. We're talking about May Swenson. We're talking with Margaret Brusha, author of The Key to Everything, May Swenson, A Writer's Life. We'll have more following this break. Thanks for listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. We're talking with Margaret Brusha, author of the new book, The Key to Everything, May Swenson, A Writer's Life. Margaret Brusha got access to the unpublished diaries of May Swenson. Also, sources include letters and many other sources to construct a life, a biography of May Swenson. Margaret Brusha, May Swenson, I guess, early life, in many ways idyllic, right? Member of the community there. Family were members of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, a tight-knit community there. But as she goes along, high school and college, high school at Logan High and college at Utah State Agricultural College, certain point she starts to realize her sexual orientation. Tell me a little bit about that.
When May was in elementary school, there was a young girl in her class, Helen Richards, and she had a crush on Helen Richards. It was a very strong crush, and she recognized it was so. It was a secret crush. She never let on to anyone, not to Helen, not to anyone, except probably in her diary. And she wondered, why she had the strong crush. So that was probably her first experience with an attraction towards females. But she went on to high school. We know very little actually about her high school years. Her entry in the yearbook under the activities of seniors is very scant. The only thing really that's mentioned is the fact that she won what was called the Vernon Short Story Contest. May entered a contest about writing. She entered a short story that she wrote in a contest and won a hefty, it would be equal to about $500 today, prize for her short story. But other than that, we don't know too much about her high school years. She maintained friendships with her elementary school friends, a girl named Muriel, who remained her friend, Muriel Morris, and also Helen Richards. So she was kind of, we don't know what she was like in high school. In the interviews with her siblings, they say that she was cooperative at home. There was no indication that she was straying from the church. She respected her parents. She got along well. Her sisters and brothers adored her. So imagine that she had a sort of normal, happy high school life. When she went to college at Utah Agricultural College, then she became very, very interested in writing and poetry, and her activities there really show the path that she had towards becoming the writer that she became. She was in college from the years 1930 to 1934, and it was a time, obviously, the aftermath of the stock market plunge in 1929, and depression was hitting, and it was also a time of student activism and unrest. She became friendly with a circle of friends who were in what was called the Scribblers Club, writers, and it was a left-leaning sort of group of people who wrote for the school newspapers and literary magazines, and she was very much a part of this tightly knit group of writers who included a fellow classmate, Ray West, another Grant Redford, a female classmate, Gladys Hobbs, and they went on to write either for newspapers or literary journals and magazines or to teach English literature, and they remained friends of May for life. So in college, she really sort of zoomed ahead in her interest in writing and poetry. She published some poems that she had written in school magazines. She also had another love affair, and it really was a love affair, with a fellow student whose name was Edith Welsh. And May, unlike the crush that she had on Helen Richards, May and Edith actually had an affair. They were lovers during college. And Edith actually lived at the Swenson household, lived with them because the Swensons lived very close to the university, and Edith lived farther away. So she lived at the Swenson house and boarded across the street. And May, it seems, hoped that they would continue their relationship after Edith graduated. Edith graduated a year after May, and May was in a state of shock and disbelief when she realized that Edith had sort of drifted away from her and was planning to marry a male student in her class. And May was just devastated, absolutely devastated. Edith got married in September. May, in November of 1935, decided that she would sort of make the break from Logan and move to Salt Lake City and leave her family. So she did. And that's what started the next phase of her life.
Before we take May to New York, that was her big ambition at a certain point. I want to talk about her relationship with her family. That relationship was always good, right? Even though at a certain point she stopped believing in the beliefs that her family had. But she never formally left the church. I guess that was out of respect for her parents.
Yes. I think there was a strong tie there for her. She has nothing but positive feelings all through her life about her parents and her siblings. I mean, she loved her family, and her family loved her. I mean, it was just a very strong relationship that gave her a sense of security from the start. And you're right, she never left. Although she was not a practicing Mormon once she got to New York, for sure, she never took her name off the rolls of, I mean, she was always registered as a Mormon, and apparently it was labeled inactive. She was very much inactive as a Mormon, but she just, you know, it was a very, her Mormon upbringing was extremely important to her. And actually, I can read if you'd like.
Yeah, that'd
there's
be great.
I have some. Let's see. Well, I have a few things that I can tell you from the book. Her sister. I mentioned earlier that there were interviews with her siblings, and one of her siblings, Margaret, later on left an account of what their Mormon upbringing was like. So I'm reading from my book on page 17. May and her family lived in a bubble of Mormonism. May's sister Margaret, recalling her childhood, described a typical week in the Swenson house. Her mother and father arose at 6 a.m. and knelt at their bedside to pray. At 7:30, the entire family gathered for a family blessing of food and breakfast. During weekdays in the academic year, the children walked to school after breakfast, and Dan walked the short distance up the hill to his teaching job. May's mother read scripture until 10 o'clock, then attended a meeting of the Relief Society, a philanthropic and educational Mormon women's organization, or visited the sick or gathered with other women to share spiritual messages. Returning home, May did housework and prepared dinner. The children either came directly home from school or attended primary, mutual, which was the Mutual Improvement Association, or seminary, which were age-appropriate religious instruction classes. The family reconvened at 6 p.m. for a blessing and dinner, usually of Swedish fare. Afterward, May washed the dishes while the younger children did homework and her parents read. At 10 o'clock, the family knelt together in bedtime prayer. On non-school days, the schedule was the same, except that all the children performed household chores, worked with their father in the garden, or were free to play. Bath time was once a week on Saturday evening. Each member of the family voluntarily skipped two meals each month. Dan and Margaret calculated the cost of their food and donated the sum to the poor in their ward, which is the LDS term for a congregation. Also, the Swensons contributed a tenth of their earnings to the church, and so on and so forth. So they lived in a very, very secure family background, worshiping, praying together at home, and it shaped May and kept their family close.
Yeah, throughout her life, right? They were still remained
right.
Close. I want to talk about her burning ambition. At a certain point, she decides, I'm going to be a poet. I'm going to be a writer. And I guess where writers need to be is New York City. So that would become her. She expressed this, right? That's going to become my new hometown. You talk about her resilience and instinct for survival, which she would certainly need. Right. It was a long time coming, wasn't it, to New York, from the time she arrived to, you know, any measurable success.
Yes, it absolutely was. And I think sort of still stinging from Edith's rejection, May went to Salt Lake City and lived with her. She had an older cousin named Sunny who lived in Salt Lake, and she decided that she would just get a job, leave home, and plan her escape. It was always in the back of her mind to New York. She had read Thomas Wolfe. She was influenced by D.H. Lawrence. She knew that she wanted to go east and get away from the life she knew and be part of what she knew was a very creative, active, artistic and literary community in New York. So she left. She went to lived in Salt Lake City. She left in 1935, and by June she had planned her trip to New York. Ostensibly, she and Sonny were going to travel for a visit to New York, and that's what May let everyone believe, including her family, that they were just going to New York to just take a vacation, spend some time in New York, and come home. But May never had in her mind to come home. She knew that once she got there, she was not coming back, but she just didn't tell anyone. And the way they went was that Sonny's father had purchased for her a car in Pontiac, Michigan, right off the assembly line. And so Sonny and May planned to take a bus ride to Michigan, 1,500 miles on a bus, and pick up the car. And then once they had the car, Sonny would drive them to New York, and they would drive through Canada, down from northern New York, and to New York City. And so in the diary, we have May's account of doing that and her stops along the way. It's very exciting, and you know, she obviously is for the first time out of Logan and seeing the world and enjoyed Chicago, and you know, the diaries are rife with wonderful references to the things that she's seeing and doing. And actually, it's worth mentioning that when they were driving on the Canada leg of their journey, observant May, looking out of the car window, saw farmers who were gathering wheat and making hay for the winter. And she wrote a poem about it called Haymaking, which actually then became her first breakthrough poem in a national literary magazine, the Saturday Review of Literature, in 1949. So that was the journey to New York.
Let's take another break, and then we'll talk about her life in New York. We're talking with Margaret Brucia, and the book is The Key to Everything, Mae Swenson, A Writer's Life. More following this break. Thanks for listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. We're talking about the life of Mae Swenson, of course, one of the most important poets of the 20th century. Her hometown is Logan, where I'm talking to you from right now. So we're talking with Margaret Brucia, the author of The Key to Everything, Mae Swenson, A Writer's Life. Margaret Brucia, before we proceed, I just want to shout out Paul Crumbly, who's Emeritus Professor of English at Utah State University, where I am right now, and he's one of the authors of the foreword. Let's see, Margaret, do we have you?
Yes, you have me.
Okay, there you go. Okay.
So shall I pick up with May's life in New York?
I was just going to say I was shouting out Paul Crumbly, who's a USU Emeritus Professor of English, and one of the authors of the foreword of the book. Just want to make sure people knew that. So she had first got there. I guess she'd support herself with secretarial jobs or living in cheap places. I guess not an unusual life for a struggling writer, but boy, it seems like her struggle went on for a long time.
It did go on for a long time, and it was a terrible struggle. In fact, when she got there, she shared an apartment on the Upper West Side with two Mormon women who were graduates of USAC, and she just sort of jumped into New York and couldn't get enough of museums, dance performances, concerts, theater, movies, art galleries, and she did everything she could, and she started out with $200, and pretty soon her money ran out, and she realized she had to work. So she put an ad in the New York Times, and she was 23 years old, and advertised herself as a college graduate and someone who was willing to do anything that would give her anything that would assure her of a living as it was something that was legitimate. And she advertised her ability to type and to write, and she placed the ad and then waited to see what happened. And a few people did respond, and the one she chose was a man who was older than she, practically the same age as her father, who his name was Paltiel Rosen, but she called him Platt. And he was interested in hiring her as a ghostwriter to write a play about himself. And he hired her to do that. He was a wealthy man. He set her up in an office building in New York. And she talked to him, planned what she would write, and set about writing this play. In the meantime, as she was writing this play, she kept writing in her diary. May was really a compulsive diarist, and she locked her diary in a cabinet in her office and realized one day when she went to take it out to write more in it that Platt also must have had a key, because the diary had been not only rifled through, but pages were missing, and she was furious. She was absolutely beside herself. And she, from that point on, although things had been going fairly well with Platt, in fact, she was kind of romantically inclined to develop a relationship with him. But once she realized that he had violated her diary, she lost interest completely in pursuing things with him. And if I can, I will try to find that passage for you, because I think it's worth reading.
Yes, certainly.
Yes, here it is. So it's from my book on page 57. She says, this is after she found that her diary had been violated. She wrote in her diary, "I was consumed with rage and in a murderous mood. We had a terrible quarrel," that's May and Platt. "Oh, it was ugly. And finally he gave me the excerpts back. I was afraid he had destroyed them. He was awfully wrought up. And no wonder, when I reread some of the things I wrote, he intimated that I was perverted. Of course he would read it that way. Anyone would. I am not bad. I am good. I am not perfect, but I am good. And I must erase, tear out those pages, write on a new page. We parted with a handshake. But you didn't understand. You saw only the lurid parts of my soul. Maybe my soul is largely that. Maybe my honesty reveals me as bad, stupid anyway." After this outburst, May wrote a warning in red ink for all future readers of her diary. And she wrote, "My diary is a record of me that no one but me has the right perspective for. All others who may read it will be deceived. Warning, you are deceived. Some things that seem to stand out shouldn't, according to the compass of my soul, and others, sometimes the most significant, are left invisible between the lines. Only I read them when I read. The juxtaposition of events and impressions are all wrong. It is no autobiography. It is a spilled mind on paper, and it is chaos for anyone else to fathom. Only for me, my book." Now, you can imagine, Tom, how I felt after reading that, knowing that I was violating her diary. I mean, it was, it was a time to sort of take a assessment of what I was doing and did I have a right to do this? And I thought about it long and hard. And I will say that May's attitude towards her diary and reading her diary changed in time. Other people after Platt violated it, and she was just as angry as she was with Platt. But then later on, when she was with her lover Pearl Schwartz, she had such a close relationship with Pearl that not only did she encourage Pearl to read her diary, but also encouraged her to write in it. So the attitude changed and shifted, and I guess I used that to justify what I was doing. And of course, having written a very paltry diary myself, you sort of realize what diaries are all about, and you understand what she's saying here, you know, that only she knows what she's saying and nobody else can give it the right perspective. And yes, that is true. But on the other hand, there is a perspective that can be learned and that can be had. And sometimes just the sequence of events in her life that she writes about, just facts, are interesting ways of finding out what May did, what she was reading, who she was seeing, and how her life was progressing. So,
yeah, certainly. What do you, you kind of got to know May Swenson here through these diaries. You're helping us to do that. And by the way, I should mention in the book, long passages, May's words herself. You want those to guide us. What's the personality of May Swenson that most, I guess the top traits of that personality that jump out to you from these diaries?
Well, incredible determination. I mean, she just, against all odds, was determined to make a career for herself, to make herself, to be able to live on her poetry, and that would be her career. And she accomplished that. And she accomplished that without contacts, without a Cadillac education, without money. She was so poor. It was the Depression. It was New York. She was just destitute, but she never gave up. And she accepted low-paying jobs to survive. She was a typist in a typing pool. She did just anything to earn enough money to get by. And all the while, she kept writing new poems, revising old poems, and hoping to get a break, which eventually she did.
Mm. Tell me about that. Finally, it's 15 years or something. It's a long slog. Finally, she started getting recognition. Eventually, she got prestigious awards, et cetera. What was her attitude toward the breakthrough?
Well, the person responsible for the breakthrough was a man named Alfred Kreimborg, who was 30 years older than she. He was a poet, a novelist, a playwright, an editor, an anthologist, a critic, and he wrote his autobiography. And he was well known in his day in the world of poetry and modernist writing. And Alfred Kreimborg met May. They met each other. They both played chess, by the way, as well, and they played chess together. But they met each other in an art class. Both Kreimborg and May enrolled in an art class that was taught by a man named Saul Bazerman, who was a sculptor, but he also taught art as well as sculpting. And Kreimborg was impressed with May and sort of cultivated her and patronized her and decided that he would help her. He knew of her determination to succeed as a poet. And he did a lot for May, actually. And May was a little bit uncomfortable accepting his help because she was so fiercely independent. She wanted to think that everything she accomplished by herself, which in many ways she did. But Kreimborg encouraged his friend, who was William Rose Benet, to publish May's poem Haymaking, which in 1949, which was her first big breakthrough. And that gave her kind of recognition on a national scene and enabled her to be a more familiar person than any event in the world of poetry. He also had connections at Yaddo. He was a friend of Elizabeth Ames, who was the director of Yaddo, and had recommended earlier in the earlier 40s Aaron Copland as a musician to be invited to Yaddo, and then Aaron Copland went on to win the Pulitzer Prize in Music in 1945. So Kreimborg's credentials at Yaddo were good, and he convinced Elizabeth Ames to invite May to be a fellow, to be a resident at Yaddo, which was exactly what May needed at that time. And she went, and that's where she met Elizabeth Bishop. She also met Buford Delaney, the artist. And for the first time, she was able to write and not worry about where her next meal was coming from and put her energy into her own creativity, which was considerable. And so Kreimborg made the path for her, but she did the rest.
Mm-hmm. Tell me a little bit more about the relationship and correspondence with Elizabeth Bishop.
Well, Elizabeth Bishop, the two of them were together. And actually, I have a passage in which she talks about her first impressions of Elizabeth Bishop at Yaddo. And I'll see if I can find that for you in a second. Hold on one second. Might not be able to Yes, here it is.
Okay.
So it was in 1950 that May went for the first time to Yaddo and there met Elizabeth Bishop. And she wrote home to Pearl, her lover at the time, and she said, "Well, at last I'm getting to know Elizabeth Bishop. She wears skirts with back pockets, has very tiny feet, wears knee-length woolen ribbed socks, spent her childhood in Nova Scotia, wears no rings on her fingers, is fond of Tennyson's In Memoriam, is 2 years older than I am, likes to drink beer, and can't hold her water. She's about my height, kind of square-shaped, rather chunky in chest and shoulders compared to her hips. The buttocks look square, the effect heightened by narrow pelvic bones and a wide waist. Nice adolescent legs. Her eyes are round and brown, half scared, half bold, and her tone of voice, no matter what she's talking about, is spoofing." So that was Mae Swenson's first impression of Elizabeth Bishop. And after Yaddo, they began a correspondence that lasted for 29 years, by which time Elizabeth Bishop had moved to Brazil. But they wrote about their lives. They wrote about their poetry, of course, but also about their lives and their relationship. I think it's easy to think that Elizabeth Bishop, who was successful before May was successful, was something of a mentor to May. But I don't think that was really the case. May was polite and listened and grateful for everything Elizabeth had to tell her about her poetry. But she was her own person, and she didn't always take Elizabeth Bishop's suggestions. So they had a good, respectful working relationship.
Just have a couple minutes left here in the conversation. I wanted to move to sort of takeaway. What you spent a lot of time with Elizabeth Mae Swenson. What's your big takeaway? What do you hope people take away from the book?
Well, I think a lot of people. It's funny because when people know that I've written a book about a modernist poet, and I mentioned Mae Swenson, some people's eyes light up and they say, "Oh, Mae Swenson. I mean, after all, she did publish 61 poems in The New Yorker, and many people do remember her." But a lot of people don't know her because there hasn't been a biography of her dedicated solely to her in print for quite a while now. So I hope that the takeaway is a discovery, and I hope that discovery spawns more writing about her life and about her poetry, and maybe placing some of the aspects in my book, maybe turning those into a better understanding of her poetry in a way that I haven't done and can't do. So I'm hoping the takeaway is the exposure. I hope that people who don't know about Mae Swenson suddenly are intrigued by her and are spurred to read her prose as well as poetry. And I hope that it generates more research.
All right, we'll leave it there. The book is The Key to Everything, Mae Swenson, A Writer's Life. We've been talking with the author, Margaret Brusha. Margaret Brusha, thank you so much. Appreciate it.
Thank you very much, Tom.
And thanks, everyone, for listening to Access Utah.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. When a wrecking ball demolishes a building, the debris is typically sent to a landfill. But by carefully deconstructing buildings instead, builders could reuse many of the old materials in new construction. In addition to reducing landfill waste, that would limit the energy needed to make and transport new materials, benefiting the climate. Fope Bademosi is with the company Autodesk's research division. She says builders could salvage more than just easily removable pieces like doors and windows. She recently studied how to reuse gypsum drywall.
The United States alone generates approximately 13 million tons of gypsum wallboard debris annually, and 85% typically end up in the landfill.
Bademosi and her colleagues use cameras, sensors, and thermal imaging to look inside a wall and spot flaws like cracks to determine what's reusable and how to remove the drywall. She says the process takes more effort, but could save builders money on disposal and materials.
We simply cannot address climate change effectively without changing how we approach construction, deconstruction, and construction materials and waste.
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To learn more about climate change, visit climateconnections.org.
This is Ag Matters.
Climate change is impacting agriculture, but researchers at Utah State University are working on a groundbreaking solution. Beneficial microbes. Just as we have helpful bacteria in our bodies, plants also rely on microbes for growth and drought resistance. Plant scientists are exploring how to harness these tiny organisms to make crops more resilient. They are investigating if it's possible to take growth-promoting bacteria from certain plants and incorporate them into others. The result could be reducing the need for chemical fertilizers, which can harm soil health. Collaborating with farmers, USU researchers work to make crops stronger, soil healthier, and farming practices more sustainable.
This has been Ag Matters from the College of Agriculture and Applied Sciences at Utah State University.